The recordings have started.
Thank you, Natalie. Good afternoon, everyone. This afternoon on the call we have Jeff Newman, James Bladel, Bertrand de la Chapelle.
Excuse me, Mike Rodenbach now joins the call.
Mike Rodenbach as well now. And we have from staff Margie Milam, Marika Koning, Glenda Saint-Géry, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. Thank you. And Alan Greenberg has just joined as well.
Great. Welcome, everyone. And a reminder, we are on Adobe Connect as well. I don't know. I see Alan just joined. Mike, I don't know if you're in an area that, or if you're in a cell, or if you're in a place you can actually log on to Adobe.
It's in process.
Great. So welcome. I envision this to be a fairly short call since we are meeting in just a little over a week in face-to-face, and we're going to have two meetings at that point. One is of the full PDP steering, I'm sorry, the PPSC, the Policy Process Steering Committee, which is open. So if anyone that's on the PDP work team that's not on the full steering committee, if you want to go and attend that would be great. It's really the first time in a while, actually since the last meeting in Mexico City, that the two work teams are going to be together again to just kind of catch up on where all of the teams are, where the working group work team as well as the PDP work team are, just kind of review status and to see what we can do to try to stimulate some more discussion and you know, see what we could do as a group to kind of push the work along. So that's that'll be next week. That'll be on Sunday at, I believe Glenn had sent around last night or yesterday the schedule, so it should be on there as to where the meeting rooms are and the times on Sunday that we're going to be meeting. Again, there's two meetings, and everyone's invited to the steering committee meeting as well as to the PDP work team meeting that we're going to have separate and apart from the working group work team meeting. So just to review, I was Bertrand just joined, and I was looks like Paul Diaz. Have you joined the phone line as well?
Yeah, Jeff, and I just logged into the Adobe as well.
Great, thanks. So there's a summary. If you go to the wiki page, and I'm not sure how many of you have been there in the last few weeks, but there's an update on there about some of the stuff that we've been talking about, the document that we've been working off of. At least the last call, and we'll be on this call and going forward, along with a summary of the contribution of Thomas Narton, who last on the last call 2 weeks ago, I think did a really good job at presenting what the IETF does before even kind of a formal policy process or working group is formed, and maybe even if a working group is never formed, the IETF goes through a birds of a feather process. And I think from the document that Thomas Narton wrote and his presentation, I think did an excellent presentation on some things that we could voluntarily recommend be done by groups that want to initiate the policy process, you know, to kind of help their formulate the either the issues report or going forward to formulate some of the issues even before the council initiates the formal policy development process. Again, we talked about on the last call that it's not, I don't think there's a consensus, well, there's not a consensus in this group that we make a birds of a feather or that type of process mandatory, but certainly it is a good idea. We decided on the last call to recommend it as kind of a best practice or as something to narrow the issues down. That I thought was pretty useful. And a summary is on the wiki, but also on the wiki is the latest document that we're working off of, the PDP planning and initiation document, which has got some notes in it from staff that has done some notes from the, including the stuff that were brought up on the last call. Does anyone have any questions of the things that are posted? I'm not sure if everyone's actually read it yet.
Jeff, it's Paul. Just a quick question. What you were discussing at the very beginning for the meetings in Sydney. For those of us who won't be there, and with the significant time difference, you know, it's going to be very difficult to dial in. Do you know, or if staff who's on the call can explain, will these sessions be webcast? Will they be transcribed? Will they be somehow posted that we can refer back to it afterwards? What are the plans for Sydney?
It's Glenn here.
Hey, Glenn.
physicians that are in the room 5 and 6 in Sydney, which includes the PPSC PDP team, the PPSC discussion group, and the PPSC work team, will all be transcribed by the scribes, and so they will be, the transcriptions will be on the website, say by the end of the day.
Fantastic.
That usually happens, I think they get them up within about 4 hours or 5 hours of the meeting. And then what I do is I chop them up, because they're very long transcriptions, as you can imagine. They sort of start from the beginning of the morning, and they go right through. So then I later on I chop them up and I put them in sections. There will also be recordings, and these will take about 2 days or 3 days to get up.
Great. Thank you, Glenn.
There you go.
And the same will happen about the OSC meetings, which will be running parallel in the room next door, but they will not have simultaneous transcriptions. They will be recorded and transcribed afterwards, but there will be a record of the meeting, an MP3 plus a transcription.
Great. Thank you, Glenn. Paul, does that answer your questions?
Yeah, totally, Jeff. It's just, you can imagine what the time, 14 hours, if you guys are meeting in the AM, it's like, yeah, right, I'm going to dial in at 2 in the morning or something. So it helps to know that those things will be ready so quickly.
Yep, I certainly understand not wanting to dial in for that. That's kind of early or late, depending on how you look at it. Okay, any other questions before we move on? Okay, so what I was saying before before Number joined, I envisioned today's meeting to be really, really short, just to kind of talk about logistics for the Sydney meeting and things that we want to talk about, maybe some ideas, push the work further. And again, since we are meeting in a week, there's really not that much of a need to kind of go through a lot of the substance. I think we've actually made some good progress. So, Marika, if you want to just talk a little bit about your thoughts on a poll and kind of pushing the discussion along?
Yeah, that's fine. We've been discussing with staff a bit, like what we could do to facilitate the discussion and maybe help as well prioritize some of the issues that we're looking at. And we thought that an idea could maybe be to do a little survey or poll by which we would use the questions or issues that we've aligned in the document that's up on Adobe Connect and basically ask people's opinion, just simple yes-no questions, as well allowing for comments so people can write further ideas in there, and just making sure that people understand as well that this is not, wouldn't be any kind of vote or decision, just a way to, feel the temperature of where people stand. And that might help the group as well to see which issue probably needs further discussion and might be appropriate to focus on in Sydney, benefiting from the face-to-face meeting, and which issues people seem to have similar views and might be easier to deal with. So this might be a way to actually force people to participate and share their views in a relatively easy manner. So there are two options. We could do such a survey or poll prior to the Sydney meeting. This might as well help participation of those that are actually not attending, like Paul, for example. Or we could use the Adobe Connect and do, questions on the spot. But then we would probably focus on, the different phases outlined here and go phase by phase. It wouldn't really help then, I think, to prioritize, because we would need that data beforehand to share that with the group. So that's something we've thought of, and then would like your views on whether you think that would be helpful going forward.
Anyone have any questions or thoughts on that? Well, I think that's it's a good idea to do this poll. I think we can. It seems like in some of the meetings we've been going back to some of the issues that we've already talked about. If we can establish within this group that we have a consensus on at least some of the issues, we can move past those and just kind of move on to the ones that we haven't either addressed or that we need to develop further. Hearing silence, Mike, any thoughts on that?
No.
Sorry, just seeing if you're still awake. Okay, and on that, also, so some of the things, if you look at all the documents are up on the wiki that we've been talking about, and like I said, the latest planning and initiation doc has been updated with the materials that we talked about at the last several meetings. There's only a few questions in there that we really don't have or haven't really touched on, and they include things like, you know, scrolling down here, if you look at the document, it's number 7, you know, talking about the role of community input, when such input and how to incorporate public comments. You know, number 8 is the role of workshops. We talked about workshops in the planning phase as far as before we launch a PDP, but we just, or before an issues report or around the time of an issues report, we just need to kind of solidify that a little bit more. And one thing that we really haven't talked about is kind of the timing of everything, what kind of deadlines we'd like to impose, you know, recognizing that there needs to be some flexibility, but also needs to be to make sure that these just working groups or that these issues don't permeate forever, but also build in the fact that there's certain times where I don't want to call it an emergency PDP, but maybe there's a lack of not a better term out there, but some sort of PDP that would be maybe on a fast track approach. I know Alan has talked about that on certain occasions.
I think it's Alan. I think since we're talking about a very wide range of PDPs, from ones that are going to be very focused on generating some particular consensus policy where everyone agrees to begin with, we just have to go through the process, to things like the new GTLDs. I think we put guidelines in for typical, you know, for typical or normal, and then council has to decide what's appropriate in any given instance.
Right. So you said council would kind of designate it as, it would be council, it would be up to council to designate it as, okay, this one qualifies for a fast track type approach, or this one should be just the normal track.
Well, typically the drafting team that's drafting the motion and the charter for the working group, you know, will have those kind of discussions and try to come to closure on, or at least consensus on what is a reasonable time frame given all of the issues around this particular problem.
Right. And then I think the last issue is kind of important as well, and it's come up in a number of, I don't know if people have read, the NCIA posted finally the comments that were received to the their notice of inquiry on ICANN, and there were a number of comments, and this is not new to anyone, certainly a number of comments during the institutional confidence review about prioritization and making sure that ICANN as a whole prioritizes the issues, because there's so much to deal with. And, you know, if one just looks at the ICANN website now and looks at the number of documents that have been posted in the last several weeks for the Sydney meeting, we have a similar problem, or want to avoid that similar problem within the GNSO of making sure there's not too many PDPs going on at the same time, or if there are, just a prioritization of those. So that's kind of a topic we have not really, aside from the fast track that we just talked about, there's not really been a discussion of should there be some sort of mechanism to prioritize these PDPs or policy issues.
Jeff, this is Marika. Just what I thought was very interesting on the discussion, the birds of a feather, is there as well, like, if there weren't enough people to actually do the work, it was basically identified as not being a priority. I don't know if a similar kind of approach could be investigated in this context, and I don't know either if that's something that the working group team is maybe looking at. If you cannot get enough volunteers to fill a working group, well, obviously it's not a priority, so should it then be, you know, delayed or put at a later time, or is there a way, as you're relying on volunteers to do the work, to use it as a mechanism to, you know, prioritize? I don't know, it's just a suggestion.
Oh, no. Can I comment on that for a second?
Yeah, sure. Just to correct that, I think Mariki said it was it was actually Thomas Norton that said that.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
That's okay. Yeah, Mike. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that's a little bit circular reasoning. I mean, to assume that something's not a priority just because we can't find enough volunteers, I mean, it's very difficult to find volunteers in my constituency, and I know in others as well, well, pretty much all of the constituencies. And Jeff's right, there's just so many issues going on at any given time that, you know, literally it's just impossible. And once things get kicked off and are in process, you can't really just say, oh, this isn't a priority, and bump other things in line. Sort of everything has to play out. So I totally support the notion that we should have some sort of planning, you know, mechanism where things are prioritized and planned out over time.
Yeah, one of the things that the IETF does, and I used to pay a lot more attention to it than I do now, but the IETF has a, they have what's called area directors, and the area directors of the seven or eight different areas, different subject matter areas, they all get together and form the IESG, and there's a number of things that has to happen before a working group can be formed, that they have to get kind of the support of the area directors of that particular area, and then it has to be brought up to the entire IESG. And one of the things the IESG looks at is the number of issues that are going on within their area or in general in the IETF, and to just kind of see whether, A, it's a priority that should be addressed, or B, whether it's something that, given the current workload, is something that could be shelved for a little bit of time. So, you know, I'm not saying that council necessarily must do that, or that it's that necessarily be the council that does it. But to my knowledge, it's not really something that the council, I'm not sure the council at this point in time actually considers all the other stuff that's going on. Really, it's just kind of an independent vote as to whether that issue merits some sort of policy process. I haven't, you know, reading the transcripts from the GNSO, I'm not on the GNSO council, but from paying attention to certain things, it doesn't seem like that kind of analysis is really done.
Certainly there are discussions held whether there are resources to do something and what time frame we should do in light of that. So I think it is factored in. It's not a formal process at the council level.
Yeah, can you just say that so it's factored in by...
Well, certainly when there's discussions, we will ask staff, you know, do you have the resources to do this? Is it reasonable to do something in a certain time frame?
But Adam, at the moment, it's not really a question of staff resources. It's really more a question of community resources, because we've seen over the last couple of weeks many calls being cancelled just because there are not enough people showing up for the calls or doing work in between to actually make decisions.
I'm agreeing. I'm saying we are factoring in, but it's not being done on any formal level. And it's hard, given the complexity of the process, it's hard almost predicting, are we going to have enough people for the working team? Can we assume we will not have, just because it's hard finding people for the drafting team to write the charter? I think those are two different things, and I don't think we can use one as a measure for the next. I'm not sure how to do it.
Could that be something that's done kind of in advance, so when a councillor votes in favor of, or a constituency votes in favor of initiating the policy process, is it possible that as part of their yes vote, they also have pre-thought about it and has solicited some volunteers at the time, so that if it does pass, they have the volunteers there?
Well, that might definitely help them to think about whether, you know, they have the scope to do the work. It might be indeed a way to say, okay, or then constituents coming back saying, well, we cannot find any volunteers at this point in time, so maybe we need a little bit more time. You know, to either think about the issue or, you know, postpone the vote for a couple of weeks to at least finish another activity that we're currently working on. So it might help people actually think about it.
We're certainly going to have problems with policy issues that affect only some part of the community, trying to find volunteers from each constituency. And we are, to some extent, we have said we must have volunteers from each constituency on working groups. And yet there are probably going to be ones where any given problem is exceedingly low priority for some constituencies and high for others.
Yep.
That's a good point. And maybe that's a question for the working group work team, is to think about whether they've talked about composition of working groups and, you know, whether I don't even know that it's going to be a requirement that a working group has to have members from each constituency.
Yeah, I mean, if constituency says, we don't really care about this one, they should be allowed to opt out.
It cannot be a requirement going forward where we can have any number of constituencies.
Mm-hmm. Well, whether constituency is now the right word or not, God knows.
Yeah.
let's not get into that discussion here.
It's good point, both of you. I think it may be stakeholder group. But that's actually a good question to see what the working group work team has been discussing about this, if they have. And I don't know if staff could provide some guidance, but certainly we'll ask them that question at the full meeting.
Jeff, this is Bertrand. Just one question. I don't remember if in the IETF or in the W3C, the area directors or the domain managers, I think it's called in the W3C, if I'm not mistaken, are there staff from the organization, or are they volunteers designated? I don't remember. Do you know that?
Well, at least in the IETF, I can't speak to the W3C,
uh-huh.
And that reminds me, I don't know if we haven't had the presentation yet from Thomas Roessler. He's just mm-hmm. had a conflict the last couple of times. But in the IETF...
Thomas is going to participate. Sorry, Jeff, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I'm not sure we're going to have Thomas. I really haven't heard back from him.
Okay, well, he'll be at... he should be at Sydney, so we'll try to nail him down at that point. The area directors are all volunteers, and there is an IETF administrative director, but he's literally just the administrative director. He's not there to write papers or anything. Everything is done by the, quote, volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
That said, when someone, quote, volunteers to be an area director, that's pretty much their full-time job. The companies realize that when they put forward someone or they support someone that is an area director, that's close to a full-time job. So I can tell you from, our experience, John Peterson from Newstar was an area director, and, that's pretty much what he did full-time, and now he's actually on the IAB, and now that's really a full-time job. There's very little else that Newstar has him do just because they know that takes up all his time.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if in the ICANN world, organizations probably can't put forth people where that's their full-time job. So it's a little bit different. They kind of rely on, in the ICANN world, we rely on the staff support.
Yeah. No, it's just because the notion of area director or domain manager, whatever the name is, indicates a very issue-oriented structure, whereas the current process in ICANN is at the moment, at least from the outside world, very structure-based and constituency-based and organizational-based rather than issue-based. And the question of priority that was mentioned before probably comes into the picture. But I don't want to diverge, but it's just a general remark.
Yep. Thank you. Any other questions on that?
I have one other issue to add whenever we get to that point that I don't think has been discussed before.
Okay, no, why don't you just introduce that, because I was just going to go over another subject that wasn't introduced, but you go first, and I want to make sure we have everything on this list.
Okay. In a number of other meetings recently, the issue has come up of how do changes get made to the output of a PDP afterwards. Specifically, we are now regularly putting in checkpoints to say, is it really working? Does it need to be tweaked? But we don't have a tweak mechanism. The issue also has come up in the new GTLDs of, assuming council in its wisdom 2 years after it published its report decides something, it got something wrong. Is there a process? What process do we need or have other than launching a whole new PDP?
And actually
to change or add something to a finished work product based on what we know now as opposed to what we knew then.
That's a good segue into kind of one of the areas I was going to get into, is that all this document is topic A. All these 11 questions are topic A, whereas there were other topics if we went back, and we'll have to revive those documents as well, because I thought that was the next thing we would get into was, okay, now that there is this... PDP, there is this working group, and the working group work team is working on their ins and outs. One of the things talk about is what happens when the working group's done with their work and the timelines and things associated with that. And then, you know, the last thing is, okay, now that the working group has come out with their report and then it's gone up, let's say it's gone up to the board and it's voted on and now its policy is for the review mechanism of, A, does the policy still make sense after time, or B, how has it been implemented and is there any tweaks that need to be done to the process? Those were kind of the other topics, and I can't remember off the top of my head whether they were, which ones were B, C, D, and E, et cetera, but those are the ones that we're going to have to get into as well.
Okay, I missed that, but nevertheless, it's something I think we need to consider.
Yep. Marika, can we revive those other topics, at least the document, to get them for Sydney? Just, I know it's on the wiki, but if we just want to put it up in a more prominent spot.
You mean the other stages?
Right. Topics,
yeah.
E, C, D.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then, you know, so because I think we're kind of, we spent a lot of time on topic A, and I think we do need to move on to the other topics, but we need to kind of get some closure, at least on some of the things, on topic A. And then, you know, I think it was the other issue that was brought up, that's number 10 here, which was brought up, I think it was brought up by Marilyn, and I'll ask her to talk a little bit more about it in Sydney, was the kind of discussion on whether to do an economic analysis on certain issues or on all issues as to, you know, going into decision of, we talked about the issues report, and we talked about, you know, a drafting team prior to an issues report. We talked about all those things, but one thing we have not yet kind of touched on is, should there be some sort of analysis by staff, well, one by staff or staff to outsource it, on an economic analysis of the issue itself, plus what it's going to take to address that issue. We haven't really spent any time. I know Marilyn brought it up at one of the first meetings, and it's kind of just been left there that we haven't really touched.
It's Mike. My only thought on that is, you just wouldn't know that at the outset of a PDP. You're not even supposed to necessarily know that at the outset of a PDP. That's what kind of what a PDP is for, to get people together and decide what that economic impact would be, among other things.
You're saying that economic analysis, if it is done, should be more at the working group stage. It should be a tool available to them.
I think it should be a specific task of a working group, part of their output.
Isn't that going to depend on the PDP, though? That there are, someone can imagine the decision to do it is based on the belief that there's an economic impact, and if there isn't, it's not worth going through the process, and that could be done at a prior stage, prior to actually initiating the policy development part.
So I think, you know, from the notes that are on this chart, it would probably be a good idea for Marilyn at the face-to-face meeting to kind of just go through, hopefully in a short amount of time, what she meant by it, and maybe there's more to it that we're just not seeing. Maybe she had a different idea than the way it was captured. So we'll just kind of put that off until then. One other item at the Sydney meeting that we'll talk about, Marilyn has posted something to the list, I think it was this morning, and she and I have talked about it. One of the problems is that the work of this group is kind of spread out, and there's a lot, I mean, people are involved in a lot of different things. Her idea is, and she calls it a face-to-face, but I'm not sure she necessarily means face-to-face, because I don't think people would get the budget to travel for something like this, or that ICANN could give people the budget to travel for this. But certainly to designate a half day or a full day at some point this summer to kind of just spend all day on this. You know, through kind of a WebEx and just go through everything so that we can really focus and push this out. I don't know what your thoughts are on that. That's a good idea, bad idea. It seems like we lose a lot of continuity with the week or 2 weeks that go by between meetings.
So I'm sorry, what's the alternative proposal?
So The proposal from the Maryland has made is to do a half day or a full day session just on this topic, some point in the summer, to just, you know, whether it's on a conference bridge or what, just to kind of crank this stuff out, and, you know, in order to get this stuff done. Obviously, there has to be a lot of planning in advance to make sure that we can get enough attendance.
Yeah, that's right. And also, it's just there's a lot of other things going on with ICANN. I personally don't think that this is a priority over any of those other things.
My impression was, since she specifically said remote working methods only go so far, is she was really talking about face-to-face.
Yeah, I think that was kind of the message in her email. She and I had talked previously about understanding that it was probably not something that really people could do face-to-face unless it was associated with an ICANN meeting, but that it was more kind of like a WebEx-type conference call. I don't think many of us could find the budget, even at larger companies like mine, to find the budget to do a full-day session anywhere.
Since we're talking about developing the process that ICANN's going to use for policy development in the GTLD area for the next 10 years, it seems a little bit like false economy not to fund a face-to-face meeting, you know, twice a year or something, if that's what it's going to take to get this right. But.
Jeff, it's Liz.
Yep.
I'm sure that, you know, ICANN would help on at least the, you know, the room and the venue and the day. You know, that could all be supported by ICANN.
If you think they're going to get volunteers to pay to go to something like that that are not registry or registrar operators, you're wrong.
Actually, let me correct that. Even a registry and registrar operators has a lot of difficulty in travel these days.
You're right. It's much more of a priority for you guys than it is for anybody else, as far as I can tell.
Well,
I'm wondering as well,
I wouldn't agree.
I mean, I would be wondering as well if people now cannot even commit the time for what we first had biweekly calls, how can you commit them to travel for some, I guess, half across the world, because several participants are as well in Europe or U.S. for a face-to-face meeting if it's not at an ICANN meeting?
If I may make a comment, the question of committing the time on the conference calls is not only a question of interest. It's also a question of overlap with other constraints that we're not completely the masters of. I think it's an interesting element that we're facing for this working group, exactly the same kind of problem that any working group in a PDP is facing anyway, which goes to the way we can structure discussions and the different stages of the discussion. But the fact that people cannot join the conference call is not necessarily an expression of disinterest. As a matter of fact, I tried to join twice, 10 minutes late, and it was suspended because there were not enough people.
No, I didn't want to mean to indicate that people are not interested, but there's as well very little discussion in between calls, and I think indeed, as you said, there's a need to, you know, focus the discussions in such a way that we get proper input and participation. But it is being a challenge for a number of reasons, other priorities and other stuff going on, you know, as we spoke about before, there's a little need to prioritize within ICANN.
But let's understand the dynamics of a face-to-face meeting are different than a call-in one. If I had to commit to calling in to 9 or 10 hours or 12 hours of meetings for 7 days starting next Friday or Saturday, I wouldn't be at more than a small fraction of them because of other commitments in my life. But I will be there since, you know, I'm traveling to Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
So one can commit to a two-day or a one-day face-to-face meeting, even including a day of travel in each direction, a lot easier sometimes than committing to a bunch of teleconferences where you're in your office and people know you are, and you can't turn down other commitments.
Right.
So it's a very different dynamic, and I don't think we should use them interchangeably.
Well, as a matter of fact, if I may chime in on this, I was saying that we're facing the same kind of problem that we have in general.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder whether what we're pointing at is not the a general question of funding and a question of repartition of funding, particularly for the distinction between groups themselves and the drafting team. Let me explain. One of the key challenges is that drafting really requires face-to-face or is greatly enhanced by face-to-face. If for whatever process you have a working group, even a very open working group with lots of input, an equivalent of an open forum even, but then there's a dedicated drafting team that is relatively limited, like 4 people, 6 people, whatever, that are sufficiently trusted by the group to be tasked with summarizing and moving the debate one step further between two consultations like that, then the question becomes, is this part of the general costs of the organization to cover the cost of the face-to-face meetings for those drafting teams, as opposed to covering the cost of the whole meetings and interaction, because that's what ICANN does already for the main meetings. This is the purpose of the one-week meeting, bringing everybody together so that they can have face-to-face meeting. They don't cover the travel expenses, but ICANN does cover all the organization now. When we're talking about working methods, we have two elements to face. One is the general workflow that starts from the very initial birds of a feather to, on the one hand, to the complete draft policy recommendation, on the other hand, that can take 2 weeks or 2 years or 5. And in the course of this process, the distinction between the general the small consultations within a working group that can extend to 40 people, the work of a drafting team that is necessarily, for efficiency reasons, less than 10 maximum, and the general consultation with the broader public. I wonder whether what we're pointing at this very moment is not the question of how to support efficiently the work of drafting teams and under which conditions.
It could be. I mean, it all depends on the issue too, right? There are some issues that are so, I'm sure that the new GTLD issue got a lot more turnout, even for the drafting parts, than maybe some of the other issues like the transfers or others that may not be on the top of everyone's priority.
I'm not sure we've in fact used drafting teams. For the ones I've been involved with, typically either staff has taken on the responsibility or the chair or one of the other people has taken on the responsibility of doing the drafting, and then the entire working group, to the extent they participate, would comment and make suggestions.
At the same time, Alan, when there was this ID and CCTLD working group, I remember that although there were a great lot of help from the staff, the group itself got into concrete modifications, including in face-to-face meeting, to the great extent. So you're right, the question of drafting teams or not is important.
Yeah, I was just saying, in the ones I've been involved with, there hasn't been a drafting team as such. It tends to be one person drafting and mm-hmm. the committee as a whole commenting and modifying occasionally on the fly during the meeting, but in general, no.
Right.
Well, I mean, other drafting teams certainly have had more participation in that.
But have we had drafting teams to formulate the end product as opposed to using drafting teams at the start of the process?
I think one...
I may just not be aware of them.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, for example, in the Fast Flux group, I mean, we had drafting teams doing various sections of the report.
Okay.
Probably another good question for the working group work team to see if they've thought about that. I'm not, like I said, I've been a little disconnected from what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be good in Sydney to kind of catch up and see what issues they've talked about and whether they've addressed this at all. Is there anything else anyone else wants to, Liz or Mariko or Margie, can you just give us an update on where the board is and what our now timeline is expected to be as to try to finalize this process? And
I'm sorry, but before you move to that, Jeff, can we just talk about this planning initiation document just a bit further?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, sure.
I'd just like to understand where we're at with the process with this document, actually. What are we in the working group supposed to be doing with this? Do we have a deadline for comments? What?
So at this point, this planning initiation doc, and I'll let Marika jump in too if she has any, is really more just kind of our notes. What's going to happen is that we're taking this document and a lot of the questions that are posted in, we'll do a poll, which is what Marika was talking about, to try to see if we have consensus on those issues. So this document is just more of a tool for us to use as opposed to kind of...
Okay. And yeah, the issue is that, you know, there's comments on here that were made on calls that, you know, I was not on, for example. And there's certainly some comments on here that I don't agree with. But I guess if I have a chance to express that during a poll or later, that's fine.
Well, actually, you have a chance. I mean, this document is a fluid document that if you have comments on it, certainly... bring them up, and we'll add the comments in there, even before poll. So it'd be just good to get. This is supposed to have all of our notes on all the issues.
Okay.
So
I mean, the one big one that keeps sticking out of my mind. I know it was one of Bertrand's proposals, I believe, was that the staff, and I know he's on the call, so I'd love to hear him explain this a little bit, if you don't mind indulging a little more time on that, but. It is, I believe he recommends that the staff make a preliminary recommendation about whether or not an issues report should issue or whether or not a PDP should issue. I can't play with this document through Adobe Connect, but I know it's down there around in the middle somewhere.
No, I think it's 4B, I think, is area.
There you go. Yeah, and the staff recommendation on whether policy is needed. General counsel comments. To me, that is a very, very bad idea because it directly puts staff in a non-neutral role, in my view.
Well, you know, the issues report asks staff to do that anyway.
Right, that's currently in the bylaws.
And the council thinks nothing of disregarding the staff's opinion.
Well, that's not true. I mean, the council does think a lot about disregarding the staff's opinion, and it creates awkwardness that doesn't need to be there. I mean, in my view, it's the council's role to be making those determinations, not staff.
Well, ultimately, it is the council's role. Staff makes it... provides advice based on staff input, and the council does decide. So that's just the current means, and it's open to change, but that is the case today.
I understand
May I chime in, because it's a very valid point, and I'd like to explain as my comments that I recorded here. Actually, what is on the document at the moment was a sort of rewriting on the fly during a previous call of a paper that I had circulated, but apparently I'm not sure that a lot of people had seen it. About three or four calls ago, I tried to summarize in a sort of draft revised bylaws the first few articles that we had discussed. And as has been said right now, the fact that currently in the bylaws, the process says the staff produces a recommendation on whether it should be continued or not. What I was suggesting, and it may not be reflected extremely precisely in the notes here, and we can clarify later, is that fundamentally we are addressing in the initiation phase the moment it starts and the moment it closes. The moment it starts, the discussion led to the notion that it would be good to have something incredibly short, very simple, that is described here like as a light issues brief, three or so pages, with the issue, the identity of the party, and the main dimensions of the issue. Actually, the proposed issue raised for consideration and the identity of the party submitting the issue and the reasons invoked for doing it is taken verbatim from the current bylaws. But the current bylaws propose only one issue report that is basically at the end of this initiation phase that lumps together what I describe here as the light issues brief and the staff recommendation on whether it is necessary to continue with the general counsel's comment and the degree of support and so on. My suggestion here was to distinguish the two, make a first very brief document that is the starting point, the main addition being the the bullet that says the main dimensions of the issue. Because what is missing in many cases today, and it can be the purpose of a birds of a feather, for instance, and this is why I raised the issue first, is to provide the dimensions of an issue. Not getting into big depth, but in order to highlight who are the impacted parties, what are the potential consequences, what is the challenge, whether everybody has a common understanding of what the starting point is. And then at the end of this initiation phase, whatever the length, a document comes out that is currently written by the staff, and therefore it says staff recommendation, but I fully agree with the notion that it is not the staff that is making the recommendation. It should be the outcome of the initial work that is embedded in a staff document. What we're touching here is a very, very delicate issue that has to be addressed, of how much the support of the staff is actually to record the agreement reached within the group, adding the general counsel comments and the degree of support and so on, or whether the group is basically giving input to the staff that basically makes the recommendation on its own afterwards. And the additional point was, in between those opening and closing documents that can be and should be briefed, both of them, there is a possibility for the board the council, to add issues, report, or suggestions that, would request additional studies in the course of this initiation phase. Because I think it was Alan who raised this issue earlier on in the discussions, that in many cases, we don't know what the duration of the initiation phase is. It shouldn't be fixed because it has to remain flexible. But it must be managed so that we know when there is a need for additional info, even at that stage, or not. So I can resend to the list the exercise that I tried about, 2 months ago or so, because the way it's formulated in here may lead to a wrong assumption. And thanks for raising the question. I hope it's clearer.
It is. And we'll update that. Marika is taking notes, and so we'll update the document to reflect what you just said and the stuff that was in your paper. Mike, mm-hmm. Does that help you?
It does help clarify. I just feel like, this is a big point for me. We need to just be really careful with terms like staff recommendation on whether policy is needed. That's just, to me, a completely inappropriate decision for staff to be making. Really at any point in the process.
Yeah, it's Alan. I have a comment also.
Okay, Alan? Yep.
Yeah. I tend to agree with Mike. As things have evolved, and I think how council makes its decisions changes over time, but at the moment, it is moderately easy to get a PDP initiated if it supports exactly the words that are in the staff recommendation, and it's becoming immensely difficult to initiate a PDP if it goes against that. Especially if there are some groups within council who are opposed to seeing a PDP.
Can you elaborate on that? Just like give an example or...
Well, I'll give an example of the post-expiration domain name recovery one that is just being initiated. And the motion and the charter for the work group are basically are verbatim out of the issues report on what staff is recommending doing. And it has been, and I think would have been, exceedingly difficult to stray from that and get it approved.
I'll give another example.
So it ends up being having the weight of law, even though it's far from that.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, I agree with that to a certain extent. But, for example, with the Fast Flux Working Group, where a majority of the council did disagree with the staff recommendation, but... I can't tell you how many times the issue continued to be raised after that, during the working group. We're constantly reminded about how this wasn't the staff's recommendation. It's just totally wrong. It was a big waste, caused a big waste of time in the working group.
Actually, it's Liz. If I could get in the queue.
Yeah, Liz, yep.
And Bertrand as well.
I wanted to go back to Bertrand's idea, because there's several things I really, really like about it, but one thing that I think is that we're struggling a little bit is that, you know, all issues are not even similar in scope and complexity. And I think what we're trying to do is come up with some apples-to-apples sort of standard, if you will, for approaching issues that, you know, we're using these examples that are very good ones, actually, and you put FastFlux and the post-expiration domain name recovery kind of together just for comparative purposes, you know, one issue that's quite broad and complex and one issue that, while complex, is much narrower. What I like about Bertrand's issue, and I think it's our idea, and it's somewhat what we're trying to get at with this template, where the initiator or requester of an issues report comes with more information than they might be required to do today to fill some of that initial gap, is because they aren't all treated equally. And it strikes me that it is appropriate to have both the flexibility to treat these issues differently, a narrowly presented issue versus a broadly presented issue, and that the steps appropriate to that have to be different. It's the same element as this economic comment that could be very appropriate and useful in some instances and really unnecessary in others. So to me, the essential ingredient that I would love to capture is this notion that at the outset there could be issues where you can't even take it to the next step without that initial data gathering, whether it's provided by the initiator or developed by a small working group before a PDP is initiated, or whether it's done by staff or some combination of the above. There is a gap in the current process to assess and scope issues that are much more complex. And so that's point number one. I think point number two is that there really, to me, is a almost internal inconsistency here about staff's role. And I think, you know, trying to be objective about it and take a step back, the reality is that there are times in this process where staff is asked to be quite substantive. Writing the issues report, if it isn't just a regurgitation of what's in contracts today or something like that, like the FastFlux report, is not a neutral task in the sense that it requires, you know, judgments and opinions and research to be gathered and analyzed in some way. It's a very substantive and extensive task. I venture to say, the purpose of it is for us not necessarily to be neutral in the presentation of the information, but comprehensive in the gathering and presentation. So I think what I would ask the group to do is talk a little more together about what they really see staff's role as appropriate here, because it's very difficult even in the current situation to know what's appropriate. And there are, I think, internal inconsistencies in the role of staff today in the PDP. So without taking a position on what I think staff ought to do, I would just ask the group to spend a little more time really thinking about what we're supposed to do here, especially in the absence of community participation or information, which is often the case. There's only so much that we get.
So, Bertrand, I think you were next.
Yeah. thanks, Liz, for this. First point is the expression staff recommendation is, as I said, and I was checking on the bylaws at the moment, if you want to look at the Annex A to E, the sentence is a recommendation from the staff manager as to whether the council should initiate the PDP for this issue, between brackets, the quote-unquote staff recommendation. So the wording is exactly that, and I think we're putting our fingers on what Liz qualifies as some ambiguity regarding the staff role. One. Second point, on that element, I think it is that we shouldn't be confusing different roles for the staff, and all of them are important and necessary. But it brings very big misunderstanding between the different actors when the roles are confused. I see at least three roles. One is providing expert input on some issues, either at the beginning or in the course of a policy process. staff is requested to bring information, to gather documents, to order studies from external actors, and bring that information back. The second thing is a more neutral support work that is basically not only administrative in organizing meetings and so on, taking minutes, recordings and so on, but also helping, for instance, a draft team finalize documents or do translations, but fundamentally recording the progress of work and saying, this is where we're at, that's the next version of the document, and help draft it, for instance. This is a relatively neutral role. There is a third role for the staff in specific conditions that are either decision-making or directly making recommendations to the board or implementing actively a specific policy. I think at least those three dimensions must be absolutely clarified, and the discussion we just had regarding the expression staff recommendation needs probably to be clarified when we discuss the initial PDP, for instance, in cases where there might be a disagreement between the staff and what the working group is suggesting, either as scope or as recommendation and so on. It's not a problem if there is a discrepancy between both, but it is important that something that comes from the staff as a reporting from the from a group is not changed because the staff has a very valid different opinion, for instance. So it's important that we keep in mind those three different functions. The next point in the same idea is that we have this problem of the one-size-fits-all, and we've been saying over and over again that we are applying the same policy development process to very different types of issues, like, for instance, a new GTLD policy or handling FastFlux. But we don't pay enough attention to the fact that we are not only applying the same process, but we're also not exploiting the possibility of a typology of outcomes. And in particular, if you do the new GTLD process, the outcome is a very comprehensive policy framework. It's a general overarching mechanism that will guide the functioning of the organization for many years. You can have something that is more operational, more concrete, that is very constraining and can be enforceable. There has been a process. The decision has been there is no, for instance, that grace period anymore. There is a need to verify that this no-at-grace period is implemented everywhere, and it's a decision. You can have something, third category, that is the equivalent of what we have in the European Union, that is a directive. It can be a sort, it's a little bit, although it is more enforceable, the equivalent of the picket fence, if this is the real word, system for the registry agreements, like consensus policies that are implemented in the contractual agreements. So it's something that is adopted generally, but that will be implemented by other actors. And then in a lighter mode, there's a fourth category possible, which is general guidelines. The outcome of a PDP could be general guidelines about how to behave in certain situations or things to care about or even information about an important issue, like it can be for IPv6 adoption, for instance. I think if we keep in mind, and I close with this, this notion of the diversity of staff role and clarification of this role between decision-making, support of the work, and expert input, and if we try to identify a typology of outcomes between general policy frameworks, implementable rules, directives and guidelines, whatever the names, we probably will simplify part of our work.
Okay. Paul?
Thanks, Jeff. I just wanted to, Bertrand's actually made some of the points and very, very eloquently. Would like to add that, you know, identify three things staff does. Yeah, I would either tease out or add a fourth and say that, you know, I think in the issues report, some of staff's role is also something of perhaps like a gatekeeper concept. You know, that making sure that the request for the PDP is broadly within scope is a very important issue. You know, otherwise, and what relates to the last things Bertrand was saying, there's often with the launching of the PDP, there is a community expectation that there's going to be some result, most often some sort of consensus policy. It won't always be the case. And, you know, I think if we, as being suggested here, as we have in our current draft, there is a valuable role in staff doing the initial report and giving some sense of, you know, what is the scope, is the issue under review within scope. Otherwise, we wind up, you know, either not setting expectations or, you know, having a conflict with the expectations of significant parts of the ICANN community in terms of what comes out of the process at the end.
Okay, thanks, Paul. I think that point actually has been raised. That was raised at the initial meeting. I think it's been raised a couple times. I think that is probably an additional fourth item added onto Bertrand's list of roles. Mike, do you have any thoughts on that? As far as, you know, I understand the language you had an issue with in the section was, you know, whether policy is needed, and I think that's a lot different than what the current bylaws say, which is just, is it within scope? And the council could ignore that, but what about, I mean, how are you as far as, would you be okay with, or are you okay with staff indicating whether they believe it's within scope either of ICANN's mission as a whole or scope within, for consensus policy?
No, because you don't know what the consensus policy, or there could be other solutions such as best practices, suggested contractual changes, whatever. You don't know what those recommendations are going to be until the working group has gotten into its work. And so for staff to be prejudging that, in my opinion, is a very bad idea and has been caused unnecessary delay and consternation on the council in several instances in the past, domain tasting and fast flux being the two prime ones in my mind right now. But no, it's just completely unnecessary. It's not staff's role to be judging what is staff's role.
So let me just how about if I rephrase it? So maybe it's not at the beginning of the process, but is there do you find any value, and this is open to anyone on the call, of staff at some point in the process saying, you know, maybe it's afterwards, saying, look, what you've come up with is interesting, maybe good best practice, but is not really within the scope of what we can mandate a registry or registrar to do through a consensus policy. Is there anywhere in the process where that should be?
Jeff, could I add any cue?
Well, that's something that, that should be brought up, at the outset for sure. But obviously, if enough people on the council think that within scope to kick off the process, then that should be the determination for the time being, until the working group gets going and issues get fleshed out.
Okay, so Marika seemed like she was first in the queue.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify, because on the scope discussion, the only thing that happens in the issues report is an evaluation whether it's in scope of ICANN's mission and GDSO policymaking, so related to GTLDs. Staff doesn't make a recommendation at that stage whether the issue could be suitable for consensus policies or anything like that, and I don't think, at least staff has never raised that they would like to have that that power, that possibility. And I think, you know, indeed, as Mike said, that determination is made at the end of the process, where you define what the group comes out with and whether that indeed then at that stage falls within the picket fence and can be a consensus policy. And I just wanted to clarify as well on the fast flux recommendation that had nothing to do with, well, there was a part where the general counsel said, well, if consensus policies will be developed in this area, you know, it's not clear which areas might fall under that, but staff's recommendation was that more research needs to be done and data gathering to really understand the issue, and that's why staff recommended to wait with initiating the PDP.
Right. So I'll just, historically, the people that wrote this, the bylaw provisions, I know it's been interpreted in different ways, But when the people that were writing it, and I was actually one of them on the initial, again, that doesn't necessarily affect how it is future, so I don't want to judge that. But initially, when those provisions were created, and I think Rita actually is the one who wrote this provision, it was intended, it was thought of that this was, at least the intent was to apply it, whether it falls within the definition of a consensus policy. Now, it's been interpreted by, you know, John Jeffrey and counsel wasn't around back then, so they've kind of interpreted it in a different way than I think if you would ask the registration registrars how they initially had thought of it and the way it was drafted. It was supposed to be for determining whether it was in the scope of a consensus policy. It hasn't evolved that way, and that is what it is. I know some registries and registrars have actually made that point that they would like to see that, but you know that's completely open for discussion. So I can't remember who was next in the queue because they're not doing hands
Alan,
up anymore.
And then
so,
Bertrand,
Alan.
I think.
Okay, Alan, thanks.
A couple of things. Certainly in the one that's on the table right now, the domain name expiration staff did make recommendations as to what types of outcomes might come out of this, whether it's consensus policy or best practices and things like that. And as I said, for better or worse, those very light recommendations do take on close to the word of law. So I think we have to recognize that. In reference to your comment on what was meant by within scope, I can fully understand that the original drafting meant within scope of consensus policies, but I think in today's reality one has to recognize that if you find a problem, it's not necessarily going to be fixed by a consensus policy. And council, I think, needs the latitude of coming up with solutions which may not be binding until the board acts or until a contract is renegotiated or until who knows what happens. But it should certainly be within council's scope to come up with what they believe is a reasonable solution to what is perceived as a real problem.
Sure.
Regardless of what that mechanism is. It's not theirs to enforce. But, you know, we're spending an awful lot of time on doing this, and we shouldn't constrain what the outcome is if it's an outcome which makes sense.
So let me ask a follow-up to that, kind of just to get your thoughts, though. Would it help counsel to know, though, when they're ultimately at the end, when they're ultimately deciding as to whether they should approve whatever policy, do you think that at some point they should know that this is the type of thing that can be imposed on a registry or registrar? And I'll go back to the registrar accreditation agreement, maybe that wasn't a formal policy process. I'm not sure what that was. But I will note that counselors were very upset when they found out. They were under the perception, and in fact, I was too, and I'm not a counselor, that once the council had approved these things, that could be imposed on the registrars, and then council was upset to learn probably 2 days before their vote that no, it would have to be voluntarily adopted, or it would only apply upon the renewal of these agreements.
10 minutes before the vote for many.
Right. So obviously that's not a good workable solution either. So at some point, do you think, and what that point is, I want to hear from everyone, but do people think it's a good idea that council knows going in when they're voting ultimately on this issue, that they know how that issue could be implemented or may not be implemented?
How could it not be a good thing? That they make a decision with full understanding of what they're deciding.
Yeah, I think that's...
The problem is you don't know that until you're through the process.
No, but he's asking at the end when you're voting.
Okay, of course, at the end when you're voting. I mean, because that should clearly be in the working group's recommendation.
Well, so let me touch on that a little bit, Mike. So that should be in the working group's recommendation.
Right.
The working group...
As to how their recommendation should be implemented, or could be implemented, if council and the board agreed.
But it's, all right, so when the working group is determining that, shouldn't they know in advance of their outcome or while they're developing their recommendation that this is something that can or cannot be imposed as a consensus policy, or this can only be a best practice, or this can only be whatever it is, shouldn't there be at some point some input from staff at the time? I mean, I can just envision a process that...
It doesn't need to come from staff.
What's that?
It doesn't need to come from staff. It can come from the registry or registrar reps that are on the working group. But yes, absolutely. The answer to your question is yes. At some point, those issues do need to be raised in the working group so the working group knows, you know, whether they're tilting against windmills or not. Right?
Right. Exactly. So I'm just trying to think of... So I think that was probably... That was the intent of the drafters of the current bylaws, was to make sure the working group knew at some point, and I guess here it's coded in at the outset, but that may not be appropriate, as you're pointing out, as Alan and others are pointing out, that it may not be appropriate, because how do you know what the outcome's going to be? But I don't hear opposition to the fact that at some point through the working group's process, they should be made aware of opinions from... Certainly, I'm sure the contracted party would raise it, but at some point, if the contracted party raises it, at some point there needs to be a staff analysis as to the validity of the contracted party's assessment, and it would certainly be helpful for the working group to know that. And so the question is, at what point, or do we just leave it?
Why does it have to be a staff assessment of that issue? That issue, staff does not make that decision, in my opinion.
I think we're talking about nomenclature. It is certainly staff's responsibility to tell us whether they think it is within scope. I mean, if we're going to end up having a legal battle between registrars and ICANN has to be willing to put their legal money up for that court battle if it comes down to it, so there has to be some belief. That doesn't mean counsel has to agree, and it doesn't mean that opinion doesn't get revised as time goes on. In my mind, the issues report puts a stake in the ground of what staff, including legal counsel, believes is the case at the time. But, you know, opinions change, or might change.
So I'm just trying to understand, are you saying that you think that it's understanding that it changes? I mean, Mike is clearly saying that he doesn't want to see anything from staff or on scope prior to the council initiating its process. And
that's not exactly what I'm saying. Staff certainly can point out that, you know, say an issue that's being raised may impact upon the picket fence or whatever, and lay out the contractual provisions. But my view is that staff needs to be purely objective in what they're doing, always, and not making recommendations one way or another.
Okay.
Jeff, this is Beth Hall. May I chime in?
Sure.
Yeah, well, actually, it's a direct continuation of the current discussion. Exactly like I was suggesting the typology of outcomes, And I think the right typology from the discussion is basically between guidelines/best practices, non-binding but recommendations, consensus policies that are binding in a specific framework, actual decisions that can be out of the consensus policy framework but that are implementable, and policy framework in general. In the same way, we're talking about staff without making the distinctions that I was hinting at earlier. Actually, if you make the distinction, and I'm grateful for Mike for this gatekeeper addition, what we see is that the staff today is structured in a way that could be organized slightly differently if we were separating the functions more clearly. Namely, there is one part that is expertise, like a sort of bank of resources for people who know issues that can go from security to anything else that is either technical or economic. The second function is the secretariat. It's a neutral function that provides policy support in the conduction of the policy processes. The third role is operational, when a policy has been adopted, there are measures to be taken, and there are things on a daily basis, like the IANA function, for instance, today, that works within the framework of a general rule that the staff is doing on a daily basis. And the fourth function is what we're discussing right now, which is a sort of definition of scope, gatekeeper, capacity to determine or to give advice on whether something should be the subject of a consensus policy, should be a decision, should be a broader policy framework, and that sort of thing. As a matter of fact, this function, with the expertise and with the policy support and part of the operational role, looks a little bit like brought together under the general denomination of staff. The reality is that this last function, which is providing a discrimination on the type of outcome that is needed, whether something is in scope or not, is a specific function that is, for the moment, as I understand, accomplished by the legal counsel. But this function, this legal function, is different from the role of legal counsel regarding the organization in general when it is representing the organization to the external world or helping drafting contracts or that sort of thing. It's the internal constitutional court of the organization. It is the one that says, this is not this process, or this should be in this framework, or it is within GNSO mandate, or you haven't consulted this or that. This is a very important function, and it's important that we avoid labeling staff in general, because in some cases we want staff to make an explicit recommendation if it is the role that we want at that stage, and in other cases the neutrality is the key functioning. So if we could try to identify the different roles of staff and how maybe in the future it will translate into a better organizational structure, maybe this is an element that we are supposedly not discussing but is inherent to the PDP reform process. And as a concluding remark, this leads to a general remark that we are currently studying many different processes for reform of ICANN in general, and this PDP reform and workgroup reform is one element of it. What is really at stake is the general institutional evolution of the organization, and I strongly believe that in the wake of all those processes, there will be a need to incorporate this in a general revision of the bylaws. But that goes beyond. I just wanted to highlight this distinction of functions for staff, and the last one of the gatekeeper and scoping of the competences is a function that is provided, but that should be also a neutral one in terms of evolving a jurisprudence internally. I hope I'm clear.
Yep, I think that is. So hopefully, Marika, you're capturing all of this and can document what we just talked about, and then hopefully we'll be able to come up with some language that we all agree on that has the flexibility, kind of reflects what Mike and Alan and Bertrand have been and Paul have been pointing out.
That's capture motive, but can I still encourage people as well to review the document as a whole and, you know, point out any inconsistencies, any things that we might have missed to make sure that we're not only adding things, but we're as well working from the right basis.
Okay. Anybody else have any other comments?
Only that I have to leave in a few minutes. I don't know what the intent is and when this call goes on to.
Yeah, no, I was going to wrap it up, actually, unless anyone else had any comments on this document. So with that said,
Jeff, if I may make just one suggestion.
Sure.
I think the document, as we said, the current document is basically recording the various elements and the various inputs. The general outcome of our work is in one way or the other, either a revision of the current Annex A or something that will not be explicitly put in the bylaws, but that will be the working methods of the GNSO somehow. Could we start working on sort of concise revision of the appropriate parts of the bylaws? Because the issues report is the part that we've been working on, and it actually takes in the bylaws three main paragraphs, I think, that can probably, on the basis of our discussions, be summarized or shortened and made more coherent and compact. I can resend the first attempt I did as a basis for further discussion. But I think the outcome would be, on the basis of what we discussed, to try to see whether we can find a simple formulation for the relevant part of the bylaws that we are changing.
Well, I think part of that, though, is that we need to decide which of the stuff we want reflected in the bylaws versus the other document, whatever that's called. And I think a lot of what we were talking about really relates to, or some of what we've been talking about relates to best practices or recommendations as opposed to bylaw changes. But I mean, if you want to submit something or resubmit it again, we'll be happy to look at it. But we kept trying to, I think initially when we had the first few meetings, we were trying to work off those bylaws, and it kind of was a little bit distracting.
Can I get in a queue?
Sure. Marika, if you want to just jump in, yeah.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to add, because I think, Bertrand, you weren't on the last call, so what we tried to do in this document is indeed work a bit that way. So if you look at the Adobe Connect, basically the idea would be to address the different issues. There are some specific concerns and questions that have been raised, and capture indeed, you know, what the discussion of the group was, and as well try to capture what the ideas were, and from there work to a proposed solution, and then indeed determine whether a bylaw change would be required for that, or whether it would be more appropriate to put this in either the rules of procedure, or, you know, create some kind of guidelines for, you know, how to initiate a PDP, or you know, which steps you might consider in you know, developing during a working group process, for example. So that's a bit the what we try to do in this document, to facilitate this discussion and moving towards discussing the actual solution and seeing whether that requires, or what bylaw changes that might require. I don't know if that helps.
Bertrand, does that help you?
Yeah, I think the two are connected. Honestly, the goal of the I agree with the notion that there probably should be things in the bylaws and things outside. But here again, we are in a strange situation in ICANN, where we have the framework of the bylaws and basically policies. We have very few, or maybe I'm not. Although no, I'm saying something wrong, because there's the accountability framework and that sort of thing. But we need to know how strong the enforceability of the of whatever policy process document will be if it is not in the bylaws. I'm personally very much in favor of as light bylaws as possible. Bylaws are like constitutions. They should be incredibly concise, and if there is an internal working methods document, maybe this can be validated by the GNSO Council as its operational procedures, for instance. I think it's a very good approach, but trying to get to the formulation starting from the current bylaws and seeing whether there are changes that can be made that are coherent with what we've been discussing, even if we put some of the things in another document that would be, for instance, adopted by the Council as its operational procedures, would, I think, be good to help us focus, and particularly when we do that in Sydney, for instance.
Okay. Are there any other questions, comments? All right, well, I thank everyone, and I look forward to seeing everyone that's going to make it in Sydney in just a little over a week.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks, Jeff.
Bye-bye.